Since the publication of Flying Saucers Have Landed, claims alleging contact with men from space have been made by numerous people, some probably true, others undoubtedly spurious, but it is George Adamski who has borne the brunt of the ridicule from the skeptics regarding such claims. Perhaps this was because he was the first to reach the public eye. An added factor is that he offered more of a challenge than anybody else in respect of corroborative evidence. There is a schism in the ranks of ufologists. Some ardently support Adamski's claims, others are open-minded about them. There are many again who are committed to disbelief for various reasons. Strange cults and pseudo-mystical movements, jumping on the flying saucer bandwagon, borrowed heavily from Adamski's story whilst superimposing their own ideas, attributing them to the space people. The ludicrous results inevitably rebounded on Adamski, whose story many people lumped together with the fantastic hodgepodge of emotionally colored, evangelical, pseudo-religious contact stories which sprang up like mushrooms in the wake of his book. This is another of the reasons for the fierce antagonism towards Adamski's allegations, for it has been said that the attention they received has been in large part responsible for the ridicule that has become associated with the flying saucer subject, and the widespread belief that people who take an interest in UFOs are members of the lunatic fringe. In trying to make the subject respectable, Adamski has been pilloried by some ufologists as the main culprit responsible for the mockery of what should be studied in all seriousness. Although not necessarily accepting his story, many ufologists on the other hand concede that Adamski has been invaluable in bringing the flying saucers to the public's attention. I would agree with them myself. He has done much to capture the imagination of people all over the globe and draw them into a lifelong interest in these alien craft. I must admit that I was one of them, for prior to 1953 I had scarcely heard of flying saucers. I had been told that they were things Americans had seen from aeroplanes occasionally, and anything that came out of America was highly suspect. My introduction to them really came when I chanced to see the review of Flying Saucers Have Landed in the Observer of 4th of October, 1953. The review was a very fair one and the accompanying photograph of the scout ship imprinted itself on my mind. Later, I discovered an article in a back copy of the now defunct magazine Illustrated, and I confess that it was the artist's impression of the handsome, blonde-haired Venusian with enigmatic smile which really captivated the romantic young 13-year-old I then was. I bought the book shortly afterwards and I thought then, as I do now, that Adamski's story was convincingly told. From that time on I had to pursue the truth about the flying saucers. Because of the excellent photographs and the support of six witnesses as evidence, many people either believed Adamski's remarkable story or were at least prepared to retain an open mind. But Adamski did not stop there. He subsequently went on to describe further contacts. Inside the Spaceships, published in 1955, was an even more sensational book than its predecessor. He tells how, in February 1953, he felt a strong urge to visit Los Angeles. After booking in at a small hotel where he was fairly well known, he mooched around waiting for, he knew not what. Suddenly he was approached by two strange men who addressed him by name. Though he had no idea as to their identity, he trusted them instinctively and accompanied them to a car park where their Pontiac was waiting. They drove him into desert country, during which time one identified himself as a Saturnian and his companion as a Martian. They turned off onto a dirt road along which they drove for some time. On alighting, Adamski noticed a glowing saucer parked on the ground and saw his friend of the first meeting servicing the craft. They all four climbed into the saucer, which brought them to a Venusian mothership lying at about the height of 40,000 feet in the Earth's stratosphere. Here Adamski met and talked with many space people and had a chance to inspect the interior of the ship. From one of the portholes he was able to take a look at outer space and found that against the totally dark background innumerable flickering lights were to be seen. The next contact was brought about in similar manner, but this time he was brought to a much larger scout ship. It was over 100 feet in diameter and he was informed that it came from Saturn. The mothership to which he was taken, a huge seven-decker affair, belonged to no one planet. It was a universal ship manned by people of many planets, and on this particular trip there were men and women from Venus, Saturn and Mars. They worked in a spacious laboratory from which small remote-controlled monitoring discs were sent out to gather data. The book tells how in the next few months Adamski had more contacts, both with the space people working here on Earth and with those in spaceships. In one of these meetings he was allegedly taken to the other side of the moon, whose image was reflected by telescope onto a screen. Contrary to what is believed by astronomers, there was enough atmosphere on the hidden side to support life, and he was told that temperatures were not as extreme as supposed. Communities were observed in valleys and on mountain slopes, also trees and a number of lakes and rivers. It is possible that these subsisted in an artificial environment, formed in pockets on the moon's surface. Inside the spaceships was more than a good many ufologists could swallow, even if they had been able to credit the first book. Such was the powerful evidence in favor of the first claim that whilst disbelieving these subsequent claims, many still believed in the first contact. The attacks were now doubled in vigor with new grounds for discrediting Adamski, such as his statements about the moon which were contrary to the pronouncements of science. Over the years a number of attempted exposes have been made, but none of these could be said to be conclusive. The supporting evidence is too strong to be lightly dismissed. On the other hand, to view of the further evidence which has come to light and which is related in this book, I deem it necessary to review these arguments briefly. For this purpose I have listed the main points or criticism which have been raised in connection with the first contact in the desert, together with the answers to them from the defending side. 1. Why were not more photographs taken of the contact, in view of the fact that in the party there were two ordinary cameras and a cine camera? Mrs. Bailey, one of the witnesses, was in the final stages of pregnancy and in a very excited state at the time. The camera she and her husband had brought was a borrowed one, and they were not used to it. They took a film, but when it was developed it was blank. About 6 or 7 still photos were taken by Adamski, but the plates were spoiled when he walked under the rim of the flange of the saucer. One of these was published in the Phoenix Gazette, but it was very poor. Desmond Leslie has examined the negatives of these and maintains that a saucer was faintly visible, about 20 feet in the air and 50 yards away over the rocks. 2. In flying saucers have landed was ascribed to Sergeant Gerald T. Baker. He has since denied he took this picture, saying that Adamski took it and ascribed it to someone other than himself to provide evidence. Desmond Leslie talked to the local mayor and 3 other reliable witnesses, all of whom testified that when the plates were developed Baker was thrilled that his picture had come out, constantly drawing their attention to it, look at the one I took sort of thing. Apparently Baker of his own free will wrote a detailed letter to whom it may concern explaining how he took the picture. No one knows why he retracted. Perhaps some sort of pressure was put on him to do so. 3. The photographs of the scout ship resemble a lampshade. They could be photographs of a model. The photographs were shown to John Ford, the film director, and Joe Mansoura, whose job it was to photograph model aircraft to make them look like the real thing for illustrations in model aircraft catalogs. He has visited Adamski and inspected his equipment. He declared that the reasons he believed Adamski's photographs were not of models was that he thought he himself was incapable of making a model sufficiently good from which these photographs could be faked. It would have been extremely dangerous for him to have attempted a fraud of this description. It was generally agreed that to have produced a fake Adamski would have had to construct a full-sized model or use costly equipment he obviously did not possess. Even then this would not have assured a good result. 4. The moon photograph in the book has been criticized because one of the saucers appears to be inside the telescope. When asked about it, Adamski himself could not explain this, but Desmond Leslie inspected the camera and the telescope and found that the two rims were not properly set so that they did not flush with one another. This accounted for what appeared to be the dark curve of the moon in the wrong place. Desmond Leslie got a similar effect when he took other photographs with the camera as a test. 5. Why was the Baker photograph blurred when it was taken with a Brownie which cannot be out of focus? Many genuine flying saucer photographs are blurred, which is due to the force field surrounding them affecting the negative. Some regard the characteristic blur as one of the tests of the genuineness of such a photograph. 6. Why was the plaster of Paris so conveniently handy at the encounter? George Hunt Williamson, one of the witnesses, is an anthropologist and always carried plaster with him on his trips for anthropological purposes. 7. Why did the party not attract attention of passers-by on the road? Also, one of the witnesses is said to have retracted his testimony. The scenery that consists of low foothills which hid them from view of the road. Al Bailey subsequently retracted his testimony, saying he could not see anything and he was sure no one else could either, but he was in a different place from the others. Alice Wells, Lucy McGuinness and the Williamsons all saw Adamski talking to a man in a one-piece brown costume. Williamson maintained that it is certain the Baileys could not have seen the incident from where they were stationed. 8. Alice Wells could not have drawn the picture of the Venusian that she did. She could not have seen the man through binoculars clearly enough to have distinguished his features. This is true, but she could see the figure when she looked and Williamson was beside her also gazing and advising as she drew. Adamski later advised and corrected the features Alice Wells admits she could not see. 9. Adamski's story was ghostwritten and embellished. This is untrue. He wrote it himself, but it was polished slightly by Mrs. Clara John. 10. It is said that during the desert contact a number of military aircraft had circled over the vicinity. Surely they would have seen and reported the presence of a UFO in the area. The Honorable Brinsley Lapoa Trench possesses a photostat copy of a letter on file written from Project Blue Book admitting that a UFO was over Desert Center on 20th of November, 1952. This was a report filed by U.S. Air Force pilots over the area on that day. A few months after flying saucers have landed came out, the skeptics were faced with explaining away a piece of corroborative evidence which was both remarkable and unexpected. To date, no satisfactory piece of explaining away has ever been adduced. On the morning of 15 February, 1954, a 13-year-old boy, Stephen Derbyshire, had a persistent nagging feeling prompting him to go up the hill behind his house at Coniston in Lancashire. He climbed the hill with his 8-year-old cousin, Adrian Meyer, and took with him a little Kodak camera, hoping they might get some good photographs of birds or scenes. While they were walking on the hill, Adrian suddenly slapped Stephen on the back to draw his attention to a queer shining object which was drifting slowly downwards from a gap in the clouds. It descended into a dip between the hills and it could not have been more than 100 yards away as Stephen quickly took 2 photographs of it. As the flying saucer flew off, it went out of the sun's rays and he noticed it was made of a plastic-like metal which light could travel through, but I could not see through it. What he meant to say was that it was translucent. It had a cabin showing 4 portholes in a row and a 3-ball undercarriage. The bottom came nearly to a point. Except for the swish as it went away, it was completely soundless. Adamski described his saucer thus: it was a beautiful small craft shaped more like a heavy glass bell than a saucer. Yet I could not see through it any more than one can see through the glass bricks that are popular in some of the newer office buildings and homes, which permit more light to enter than would solid walls. It was translucent and of exquisite color. Leonard Cramp made an orthographic comparison of the Adamski scout photograph with that taken by Stephen Derbyshire. The procedure, together with the full story, is described in his book, Space, Gravity and the Flying Saucer. This showed that the Coniston saucer was identical to that of Adamski's. The integrity of Stephen Derbyshire and his family is beyond question. The question posed is, if Adamski's photograph is a fake, where did he obtain the original on which to base his fake? Corroborative evidence of another kind was brought to light with the publication of a book by the French explorer Professor Marcel F. Hornet. Sons of the Sun was first published in 1958 in German and later in English in 1963. It describes the discovery of symbols closely resembling, and in some cases identical, with those on the photographic plate Adamski received from the Venusian in 1952. The symbols were found among several thousands of characters on a huge boulder in northeastern Brazil, known as the Pedra Pintada. Their age is estimated as at least 10,000 years, but more likely as 30,000 years old. Adamski said that in a subsequent meeting, his Venusian friend told him that the messages he gave him were of a universal character. Published by Neville Spearman. In his first contact, Adamski learned that large numbers of other planets throughout the universe are inhabited, and on inquiring how many were inhabited in our own system, the answer was given by a large round sweep of the hand with vertical sweeps across it, implying that all of them were. He indicated that the form of the inhabitants is more or less universal and tried to elaborate further with more gestures, perhaps trying to say that there were differences in size and color, etc. This information cuts right across all that modern astronomy has told us, although some scientists go so far as to admit the likelihood of life of some form on our nearest planetary neighbors, Mars and Venus. Conflicting data has been received by our scientific instruments regarding the temperature and the atmospheric content on Venus, and some have ventured that conditions there may not be much different from that of our own world. However, if all our planets are inhabited, there must be some radical flaws in our knowledge, and it is not surprising that Adamski's claims should be so unacceptable to most of the orthodox scientists. Scientists once theorized that the major planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, were each a huge mass of rock overlain by a sea of hydrogen and with an outer layer of gases visible to telescopes. Another, more recent theory, holds that each of these planets is an enormous sphere of hydrogen which becomes metallic towards the center owing to the enormous pressure exerted. Spectroscopic studies seem to confirm that one or other of these theories was correct. Now, however, the spectroscope is no longer regarded as infallible, and it seems that astronomers do not actually know very much about conditions on other planets. All old assumptions may well prove incorrect. Despite all the official cover-ups, one thing cannot be more certain, and that is we are being visited by alien spacecraft, whether they come from our system or outside it. For the last 20 years they have been arriving in great number. Many, many different models have been observed, although there seem to be a few basic types such as the motherships or carrier craft which are generally cylindrical or cigar-shaped, circular scout ships, flying saucers, and small remote-controlled devices. An increasing number of well-attested cases are brought to notice in which landings and the occupants were seen. The saucer people vary a great deal in size and superficial characteristics, but with very few exceptions they are reported as human or humanoid in appearance. These sightings confirm Adamski on that point at least, for with the great variety of types of craft and the differences in their personnel, we are obviously being visited not only by the people of one planet but several different planets, even allowing for racial differences such as we have on our own world. If Adamski is right and some of these people arrive from systems beyond our own, then it is probable that they have mastered properties of space of which we have no knowledge. Even if we could attain the speed of light, the time taken to reach our nearest stellar neighbor would be 4 1/3 years. Unless our visitors have an extremely long lifespan, it seems unlikely that they would travel many years to pay us a casual visit. There is a prediction of the theory of relativity which states that for a moving observer time moves slower than for an observer at rest. Controversy reigns amongst physicists on this. Some postulate that the effect would be counteracted during periods of acceleration and deceleration, so that a space traveler would not return to his own planet to find his fellows more aged than himself. If time dilation docks occur, then visits from the inhabitants of distant solar systems would be not only feasible but probable. And how can we be sure that the speed of light cannot be surpassed? There can be no doubt that many alleged contactees were inspired by Adamski and invented stories based upon this. It is not surprising that a number of researchers tend to look with favor only on reports of encounters with space beings who behaved with apparent indifference or, in a few cases, hostility. The orthodox contact, the kind in which conversations on religious, scientific or philosophical matters are alleged to have taken place and where the contactee seeks to publicize his story, is dismissed. Nevertheless, there are quite a few well-attested borderline cases involving ordinary people when they were quite unprepared for a contact. In these cases the witnesses do not seek publicity, indeed, they frequently try to avoid it. Their reaction is often one of annoyance or puzzlement. Take the following example, reported by three separate witnesses, none of whom wanted to give their names. It occurred on 20th of July, 1956, in Panorama City, California, near Los Angeles. The first was a housewife who saw a tremendous object shaped like a ball land near her house. Three occupants emerged. Each was about 6'8" in height, wearing a tight green suit and with long blonde hair hanging down to the shoulders. They told her they were from Venus and would not harm her, but she thought it was some kind of stunt for a movie company and told them to get off her property. Only a few minutes later, in nearby Van Nuys, a telephone lineman was startled by an enormous ball landing only about a foot from the pole on which he was working. I was so scared that I felt like getting on top of the pole, but instead I got down and started to inspect the huge ball. Just then three guys walked right through the ball and came toward me. The men were very friendly and shook his hand. They seemed to be holding some kind of mental communication among themselves, he continued, but they spoke with their mouths to me. Yet another witness was startled when the UFO landed on his front lawn and the three occupants started toward him. The dogs kept barking so loudly that they apparently became frightened and left. They just got in the ball and vanished. To the delight of his protagonists, Adamski's description of outer space was apparently verified by the observations of astronauts as they orbited the Earth. In Inside the Spaceships he says, I was amazed to see the background of spaces totally dark. Yet there were manifestations taking place all around us, as though billions upon billions of fireflies were flickering everywhere, moving in all directions as fireflies do. On his trip through space on 20th of February, 1962, Colonel John Glenn, one of the first American astronauts, had this to say, these little green things that I thought at first to be stars were actually a bright bluish green, about the size and intensity of a firefly on a really dark night. These little particles were about 8 to 10 feet apart, and there were literally thousands of them. It is debatable whether Glenn's description tallied with Adamski's in every respect. Whilst his description of them cannot prove he was ever in space, they are certainly a point in his favor. In all, there is no proof that Adamski was telling the truth, only circumstantial evidence, nor, on the other hand, is the proof that he was not. There is no gainsaying the fact that he stuck to his story throughout the years, in the midst of ridicule and scorn on the one side and all-believing adulation on the other. I never met Adamski personally and have only heard tape recordings of his lectures. Not being able to claim first-hand knowledge of what he was like as a person, I can only judge him by what others have said. Although on the whole people flocked to his lectures, he was by no means his best on the public platform. His thick accent and general approach tended to shock English audiences in particular. By temperament he was impetuous and intolerant of those who disputed with him, as might be expected of one fanatically aware of his own truthfulness. Many complained that he would not give a direct answer to a direct question. Those who met him found he had a charming, compelling personality. Although perhaps convinced of his sincerity, some would prefer not to commit themselves to belief in his stories, saying, by way of compromise, he had an experience. For many he did not live up to their ideas of what a chosen contactee should be like, expecting a Superman or a saint. Disappointedly they found instead a human being with human failings. He liked to enjoy himself and despised asceticism. He was a heavy smoker and liked a strong drink, but this does not mean to say he was an alcoholic, That was just a vicious smear eagerly seized upon by his emotionally biased opponents. Every night he would partake of an old Polish health remedy consisting of about a third of a tumbler of neat whiskey with pepper in it. He needed only 3 or 4 hours sleep 8 nights, yet he had the energy of a man half his years. Perhaps this was due to the old Polish health remedy. The news of George Adamski's sudden death on 24th of April, 1965, carried in the late flash of the May-June issue of Flying Saucer Review, came as a shock and not without a touch of sadness to a great many saucer fans, whatever their views on his claims may have been. One might have supposed that the controversy surrounding this colorful figure would gradually fade away and be forgotten. When I read Desmond Leslie's obituary in the next issue of Flying Saucer Review, I paid very little attention to the last paragraph. It sounded too wishful and unlikely. But that ending was only to be the beginning of this story. We shall miss George. Miss him very much, but I cannot feel sad at his going. He gave his utmost to the work and the world will never be quite the same place again, richer for his coming, a little poorer for his going. But I don't believe we have seen the last of him. If he is reborn on another planet, he has promised to come back and contact us when possible. With George anything could happen. And usually does. Dear old spaceman, go in peace. Appendix 2, The Mitchell Sisters Report. Among others who have claimed contact with extraterrestrial human beings who say they come from Venus are the Mitchell sisters from Texas. Helen and Betty Mitchell were told that they had been watched from a very early age and were in a sense guided in their development to adulthood when their first conscious contacts with these watchers began. We are very familiar with this pattern now. But in the 1950s when these events were taking place, this kind of preparation was unheard of and was thus rejected by most researchers and all the organized UFO dubs. Conditions were then much as they are now. We fear what we do not understand and we attack the unknown all out of a lack of knowledge. If we were a little better informed, we would see the foolishness of our attacks. Now our science tells us that we cannot perceive any sign of human habitation on the Venus we see with our instruments. The extremely high surface temperatures and the excessively high pressures at ground level are simply too hostile for physical life as we know it. But is physical life as we know it the only intelligent life in our solar system, or elsewhere? We are told by students of metaphysics, and even by various extraterrestrial visitors, that there is life everywhere, in different degrees of manifestation. They say that the life wave on Venus exists in a level of vibration different from ours and is only perceivable by us when the Venusians slow their rate of vibration down to match ours. They tell us that there is a life wave of Hunan beings in evolution on Mars also, but that it vibrates at a different rate from ours and that of the Venusians as well. They both nave to control their natural vibrations into ours to interact directly with us. Here, then, is a brief description of the Mitchell sisters' contacts with Venusian visitors as taken from a platform lecture in 1959 and published by the late Gray Barker. This report is offered in support of the contacts described in the text of this book. Publisher. We Met the Space People, The Story of the Mitchell Sisters, by Helen and Betty Mitchell, Sorcery and B.O.Ox, Box 2228, Clarksburg. An address delivered by Helen Mitchell at the Buck Nelson Convention June 28, 1959. Ladies and gentlemen, since many of you have never heard our story before, it would hardly be proper for us to go into a lengthy discussion of what the space people have told us without first telling you how we came to meet the brothers. 2 years ago, in May of 1957, Betty and I were in a downtown St. Louis coffee shop. We had been shopping and had stopped off to get a Coke and refresh ourselves. While in the coffee shop, we were approached in a very mannerly way by two gentlemen dressed in gray suits, who managed to interrupt into our private conversation. As they spoke to us, we found that they were from a huge mothercraft orbiting the planet Earth, and that their names were Ilan Anzalus. They told us that we had been very closely watched by the space people for the last 8 years, and that our progress had been noted off and on from the time of our birth. Betty and I were both inclined to think that someone was playing a silly joke on us, and we laughed when they told us this, but they were not laughing and were serious and stern. We were strangely shocked, however, when they told us of a few incidents in our childhood that no one could have possibly known excepting the family. They told us that we had been selected as contacts by the people of space to serve as channels through which they could give certain information to Earth, and that we had been carefully watched, as I stated before. They told us of the reasons why the space people were coming to Earth and that they were here to guide Earth along the lines of brotherhood and science.